I'm going to ask Councillor Dirksen to read the safety briefing.
Thank you, Madam President. In the interest of safety, please note that we are on the third floor of this building. So in the event of fire or if there's a fire alarm, please exit out of the nearest door and meet near the Table 6 restaurant in the plaza. There is a defibrillator located on the right wall of the steps leading down to the Grand Avenue entrance of this building. And in the event of a medical or a fire emergency, please call 911 first and notify the security agent that is at the front desk. And the nearest fire extinguisher to where we are is in the hallway on the right-hand side at the front of the room.
Awesome. Thank you. And in the event of an emergency, there are two.
Lights are not working.
Turn on to guide you to.
Who puts on whose mask first?
Mom. Mom puts on the mask.
In the event of 3 inches of rain tomorrow, their flotation device mobile.
Exactly. And with that, Tim, welcome. We have a work session on budget prep.
Excellent. Good afternoon, Council President Peterson, members of the Metro Council. I am Tim Collier, the Director of Finance and Regulatory Services. Today, we are going to review the current status of the budget with regards to particularly the general fund, but we'll also be reviewing some of the enterprise funds to talk a little bit about that. It's really to give you a base of kind of where we believe we are, an opportunity to ask any questions and have any discussion amongst yourselves. Then Martha will be making her final decisions with regards to the ad packages to bring forward to you on March 1st, and then we propose the budget on April. There will be some time to amend between then and May before we send the TSCC for, of course, the TSCC hearing in June, final adoption at the end of June. So with that, can we bring up the... Can see these? Okay, excellent. All right. Throw me a curveball. You have these?
Path of Opportunity.
Yes, exactly. We are rebranding from the Jaws of Death to the Graph of Opportunity. So we'll go over the general fund first. If you'll see on the general fund revenues and expenditures, as I've often said here, no good government forecast, five-year forecast, does not show a gap at the end of the fifth year. Right, so this one here shows about $5 million. Where we get concerned is as that gap actually moves closer to the current year. So the last few years the gap has been 5 years and really out. You'll notice on this graph we're actually seeing where the general fund will go negative to the tune of about $1.7 million in the 21-22 fiscal year. Now, that right now assumes no additional FTE adds, right? That's just where we are at this time with the January amendments. So if you look at what we would expect in the future, we'd be looking at about $1.7 million in about 2 years out. Now, will that actually happen? No, because people underspend, vacancies, et cetera. But it's something that we need to be really considerate and thoughtful of because it can expand pretty rapidly. So I just want to give you that context up front. Well,
Tim, before you go, does anybody have any general questions about that? So that is existing FTE status, which does include the positions you approved in January.
Yep, includes those, and it includes the $500,000 subsidy for the housing bond, the admin costs. So it does include those things.
Just curious, the dip in the revenue for 1920, what created that?
Let's see, $1.2 million.
Going up on 18-19, it has a slight dip in 1920.
If I look at that, that would most probably be because of beginning fund balances that we would have eaten into, would be my guess.
And I would also guess it's largely because of things like the transient oriented development program actually spending some of those things that would have been fund balance? Yes, Lisa's looking at me like, no.
Well, the beginning fund balance is dropping largely because the expenditures are beginning to exceed the resources.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think we also are a little more conservative on how we projected the CET due to the constructionist.
Can't go on forever.
Can't go on forever, correct. This also does not forecast, of course, any recession or anything like this. It's really the current growth rate, et cetera, is what this.
We acknowledge, Tim, that we just used an acronym, construction excise tax, and try to set the context for the construction excise tax in our funding strategy.
Yes, the construction excise tax is, of course, a tax on new construction or construction and remodels, et cetera, it's 0.12% up to essentially $12,000 per project is the maximum. Those then fund our 2040 planning grants currently.
What is the tax, half a percent?
1/8 of 1%.
Yeah, 1/8 of 1%. 0.12.
Yeah. Is there a second to the motion for making one happen? Just kidding.
Unfortunately, we are preempted by state law.
Yes.
Okay, any questions on the overall general fund?
The question that I had is addressed in slide 2.
Okay. Excellent. So, thank you. And he was not a plant, I swear. So, one of the reasons this driver is, and you see in the next slide, is really our personnel services. A big portion of this, of course, is the PERS increases, right? So, you will notice in 1920. So PERS, the state or the PERS board sets the new rates for a biennium. So the first biennium with the new rate will be the 1920 biennium. So it'll go 1920, 2021, and then there will be another increase, 21, 22. So this graph actually shows 3 additional increases in the PERS rate. Those, and again, this does not assume any additional FTE. This is based on the current FTE. So what the two outlying, so the 21-22 and the 23-24 time periods, those are estimates. What we know right now is from an actual, the actuary has said that we can expect for at least the next 3 biennia a similar increase to the increase that we received this biennia, which was about 3.9% on covered payroll, which in the general fund means about $1.1 million. So we're going to see those. So even if we saw roughly 30% gains in PERS, you're still going to see these increases. It really does not matter how much PERS increases or how much PERS makes. So
through its investment strategy.
Through its investment strategy, sorry, okay. Yes. Through its investment strategy, correct.
I have a 10,000-foot question. What percentage of our total budget is the general fund? And what I know we have other...
Operating, probably about a quarter.
Quarter, yeah.
Okay.
Roughly.
And then we
total
have...
Total less than a quarter.
Right. And it's the one... The reason we talk a lot about the general fund is, one, it's the one that has more restricted revenue sources, but it's also truly the one where there's a lot of discretion on what the council can actually spend those dollars on. So a lot of the programmatic stuff that you like to do can be done in the general fund. So we spend a lot of time on that. Okay. Next one is, and Martha made me promise I would go slow on this, so I will. This is the charter limitation on expenditures. So what I have here is the charter. So this is really easy, I'm going to say. So except as provided in this section, for the first year after this charter takes effect, Metro may make no more than $12.5 million expenditures on a cash basis from taxes imposed that increases by CPI every year. What are the exclusions? Exclusions are taxes approved by voters of Metro, payroll taxes, and tax increment financing charges. So essentially, what does that actually mean? What that means is those taxes that we impose, so in our case, the excise tax, has a cap not on how much you can raise, but actually on how much you can spend, right? So The way the charter actually works is that we could, if you'll look at this chart, you'll see outside here that cap limit. So that 12.5 million is now roughly 24, a little over 24 million for 1920. Okay, you could raise $35 million on the excise tax, but you could still only spend that 24. The 11 million would actually go back into the general, or would go back into the fund balance, and then you would have to spend it based on the charter in later years. So when we look at this chart, the reason I bring this up is this is one of the levers that the council has. It is probably not a lever we would look to use in 1920, but it is something that you could have discussions about in 2021. So again, going back, if you look at the chart, you'll look at 16-17, 17-18.
I have a quick question. Shoot. So this is the third time, I think, this week I hear someone talk about 1920. And I'm just really confused by what you mean by that.
2019 and 2020.
Yeah. Oh, 1990. Sorry. I'm sorry. So
the first year is
2019.
Is
it
not?
Oh, so the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2019.
Tim, does that mean that we're carrying a fund balance because we raise more revenues than we can?
No,
that does not. We are not.
I just heard. Sorry.
If you were to raise the excise tax above what we have currently, or what the charter says we can spend, then that would go to the ending fund. But we have not reached that yet. So you'll see that here. The bottom dotted line is actually the.
I actually don't understand. So take me through the whole chart rather than assume that I know what I'm
looking at. So if you, I'm sorry.
I just said we're talking about the solid waste excise tax, not the construction excise tax, right?
Oh, right. Well, that's not. Yeah, let me if I can walk a little through that first. Okay. If you see the top line on this chart, the top line on the chart is actually the spending cap. So it is the cap in which we are limited to what we can spend excise taxes on. At the current rate. So in 2019-2020, it will be roughly $25 million. So that's the maximum you could spend if you receive that money. The bottom number, the bottom dotted line, is actually the actual expenditures that we've done under that cap. So in 1920 again, it is about, what was that, 19 million, over 18 million. Okay. So you have roughly 5 million. If you look at the very bottom bars, that tells you roughly what the gap is or revenue that could be raised to be able to spend on these expenditures, right? So it's about $5.5 million in 1920.
Take it back one more level.
Not hitting home at all. Sorry.
Without voter approval, we can have excise taxes up to a certain level.
No, if you have, without voter approval, yes, you can have, you can spend excise taxes up to this level. So in theory, you could raise $24 million in excise tax and spend $24 million in excise tax. Right? In theory. In theory, what could happen is you could spend, so you could raise it all. Right now, we receive about $18 million in excise taxes, and we spend about $18 million in excise taxes. You could raise that limit up, and it is going back to the only tax that now applies to this is the solid waste excise tax and the excise tax on paint.
So,
basically.
So what you're saying is that theoretically, the council could raise the excise tax even past the point of expenditure to go into the general fund to make a deficit for future years.
But you can, what I'm trying to say, I guess, and I'm not doing a very good job of it, is I know, is that you can raise the, so right now, the solid waste excise tax is limited inside of our code to a yield base, right? So the solid waste excise tax.
I don't understand that word, so take it back one more step.
Okay. So in the code, every year, a solid waste excise tax revenue is limited to what is, there's a yield. And right now that yield is roughly $15 million. So you have set that you need, the council needs $15 million to be able to do the function of the government, right? So that is in the code, not in charter, but in the code. Okay, that actually raises, because once we divide by the number of tons, and the tons are always a little low, we actually raise $18 million. Okay, so you actually raise $18 million off the solid waste excise tax, and you spend that $18 million. Okay, you could change the code to move that yield number up to 22%.
So what you're saying is the excise tax can be raised.
The excise tax can be raised.
To make
violating the charter.
And looking at
$5 million.
Oh, I'm sorry. Deficit means not enough money.
Hey, could you say what you were saying, Councilor?
No. Go ahead.
Excise tax could be raised up to the cap.
Yeah.
That's the summary statement.
And then,
without voter approval.
About $5 million a year,
roughly. Yes.
So, what number is actually in the charter?
The charter is, right now, that's the top number, that's the $24 million. So that's the one you're actually limited by the charter.
But is that number in the charter?
No. It started out at $12.5 million and is increased by CPI over the last 20 years.
Right? The number in the charter is the number that CPI has expanded.
Right. So it started at $12.5, went up to $24.
So Tim, you mentioned, so now we understand, I think, the revenue side, but you also mentioned that we are capped at how much we could spend even if we raised more. So, and then that the leftover of how much we would not be able to spend from the difference in the revenue would pass on to future balance.
Right. So let's say, for instance, that you decide that the council decides to raise the excise tax to actually hit the $24 million you can spend. But what actually happens, because tonnage goes, crazy, we get some extra tons, you actually collect $26 million, okay? You're still limited that you can only spend the first $24 million. The other $2 million that's remaining that you've collected would now go into the ending fund to be spent in future years.
But what's the restriction in that future years? I mean,
same. It has the same color of money. It
doesn't lose its color of money.
Doesn't lose its color of money in theory. Yes,
well, subject to the limitation.
So just hypothetically, if we had a goal of increasing our ending fund balance, we could choose to raise the excise tax above the cap by statute and by code. We could raise it above that, and then that excess money would then go into and become into the general fund and be ending and increase the ending fund balance.
But
correct.
You couldn't spend it.
But you couldn't. You
said we could raise the excise tax to the spending cap limit without a vote of the people. Can we extend it above that without a vote of the people?
Sure, you just
acknowledging right up front that we're not going to spend it. It's just going to go into reserves.
But then, if we can't spend it, then what impact does it have on our budget deficit? I mean, when can
we? Why don't you levy a tax you can't spend?
I agree. I'm just trying to clarify the difference between charter and code language and what our limitations are without a vote.
The last question here, hopefully. Is I'm assuming that we need to justify the rate that we set.
It's a tax.
So in the, of course, there will be natural opponents to this tax, and that would be the solid waste industry. They do not like the excise tax. So they would be the ones that would probably not like us to raise it.
So let me be clear. You're right. What we would come talk to you about is your choice would be if we got to the point where we were going into the red, would you prefer to raise the tax to continue to provide certain activities, programs, and services because that would be the nexus between the tax.
Thank you. Yeah.
Or would you prefer to reduce program services and activities? So that'll be the, we won't come to you to propose that you raise any taxes that you don't need to operate existing services. But if we get to that place that Tim has pointed out in year three, we may come to you. And the thing about the excise tax that's different is we do have many other sources of revenue in the general fund, but this is the only one that the council has jurisdiction over without having to go to a vote of the people or dependent on Congress or the state legislature to act. So that's the reason we talk about this revenue source.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
What is the purpose of that spending them? Why was that put in the charter in the first place? What was trying to be achieved by that?
Wait,
phone a friend.
I think it was probably the solid waste industry was concerned because it is unique. The rest of Oregon's major general government taxes have limitations on them, and so I have a feeling the solid waste industry was concerned that we would...
Property tax, excise tax.
Yeah, that we would just raise taxes on solid waste, let me just say willy-nilly. And so the charter limitation was probably... Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't need to give you any more idiomatic expressions.
He was a member of the charter committee.
But I have a feeling that we were concerned about getting the support of the solid waste industry for the charter, because we needed a home rule vote. And so that was probably something we did as a compromise.
Would there be a reason we would ever consider to change the charter?
I would never advocate for you to go out on a referral of the charter unless you had something really significant that was an impedance. Never.
Open up the Pandora.
Never take the Constitution to the voters unless you really have to.
Any other questions? It's always hard. It is.
No, that was easy. With
thank goodness we get new members of the council every once in a while, so we all get a refresher.
Yeah. It was a crowdsource. Go for it.
Okay. All right. So the next one, we'll talk about the enterprise funds. I don't have the solid waste rate. Typically, we talk about solid waste rate out. We haven't quite figured that out yet. I'm sorry.
Before we get on to the enterprise funds, going back to slide two, it's clear that our expenditures, the biggest rise in expenditure are things that are outside of our control, essentially, like PERS and added benefits, of course, mm-hmm. that we want to pay our employees. I'm not going to ask you for a solution to PERS or anything like that, because that'd be... I guess I need to do more research myself, but I've heard from different people that after a certain point in time in the future, the PERS system reaches a critical mass where the restructuring and just people no longer able to access it for natural reasons of passing into different dimensions. What does that forecast look like, more or less? I mean, how much time before the PERS naturally starts to decline? Due
25
to the
years.
25 years?
Essentially, the tier ones, tier two individuals have to
die.
And then you
from my perspective.
And your tier three or opser people have become a higher percentage of the fund.
Yeah.
And I believe what Milliman, who is the state's actuary with regards to PERS, has said is that we can really look at five more biennia where we're seeing these increases, and then we should see a leveling off and then back down. So really you're looking at the next decade, and then we should start seeing a little lower.
Slow decline.
So basically we're just going to ride it out.
And there's not a lot you can do. The funny thing is my dad's the guy who sues PERS, so he has made sure that everything that makes a change to PERS now is prospective, right? So all the benefits that are earned up to this point, pretty much contract law, everything beyond that can be changed, but those will not necessarily impact the fund for 20, 25 years.
It is important.
important to know, I think this is correct, that as we add FTE, we also add the proportionate increased liability of that extra PERS, right?
To a certain degree, yes, but if we actually add new employees who are actually OPSERP, it can bring your percentage of the liability down. Those, if you bring over more employees that are tier one, tier two, yes, but if it's, you're bringing in a whole bunch of new employees that are tier three, then that actually helps bring your liability down.
Okay, so it's not that we have a rate that's based on the number of employees, it's the ones that we have that are tier one that define.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the ones who already retired from that.
Mm-hmm. That's what it looks.
Okay.
I have a question. Have we thought through, I mean, I just think that as a relatively younger government and we've had different rates of growth, have we thought through the opportunity to have a side account for PERS just to kind of protect ourselves since we're a more unique agency than other local governments?
We do have we bonded with a series of other local governments back in 2006, I believe, to do one funding. We are also investigating right now, the last session, Governor Brown came up with trying to find some additional funding. They're not sure on that process yet. They're not sure where the additional funding is coming from. So we'll look at that. And then lastly, we do have what we call a PERS reserve, which actually helps offset the bond payments, but that will be actually run out in 2 years, 3 years, something like that.
So at least we had one.
Yes, it's been very beneficial for the departments, but it will actually increase the rate here in a few years.
Yeah. Would you put effort into restoring that?
So anything we do, Tim and I talk about this year, everything we do to set money aside for future years just creates less money for you to spend in current year. And so it's just like everything else. You're constantly balancing how do you maintain and guarantee current and desired programs and activities versus worrying about the future. The hardest part about PERS, I think, really is we are, a substantial portion of our payment is to pay employees who no longer work here. And we do, it's our obligation to those folks, right? But it's on all deferred maintenance. It sort of like catches up to you eventually. So that's kind of where we are with PERS. And frankly, we think of it as a debt we owe, and that's how we treat it. That's what we've done in the past. If we have one-time dollars, we use them to offset future increases.
Okay.
Moving on.
All right.
Any more questions on that slide? Yep. You want to go to enterprises?
Yep. All right. We're going to the enterprise funds. So first is just the Oregon Convention Center forecast. You'll notice this one here, this is just strictly operations. This does not impact the capital account. The OCC's capital account is funded through net operation gains and through the transient lodging tax pooled capital. And so you'll notice actually the OCC is looking fairly healthy. Again, does not assume any FTE increases or any changes, just where we are at this point in time. And that's over the next 5 years, so it still looks fairly healthy. When you move to the next one,
that's a ringing endorsement from a finance officer. Fairly healthy.
When you look at the Portland 5 Center for the Arts forecast, it gets a little less rosy. You'll look at, again, 2021, we're looking fairly good. What drives a lot of the revenue at P5 is how many weeks of Broadway we have. So we, like in 1920 right now, we are projected to have 13 weeks of Broadway. A typical year is 9. A bad year is 6. And so 1920, we're going to have 13 weeks. But we don't estimate 13 weeks every year. So as you go out and you lower the number of Broadway shows, then that will impact the overall revenue stream. Again, one of the issues we run into with Portland 5 is we don't have a clear delineation, like what is the responsibility of the city of Portland, what is our responsibility with regards to capital. So as we try to figure those things out over years, so right now a lot of the deferred maintenance is spent by the fund balances of P5. But any major renovation would have to be done by the city of Portland. So right now, we just spend on the deferred maintenance, and there we go. Questions on P5?
No, but I'm assuming that's part of our asset management discussion and plan.
They are. We, again, the conversation with the, so the city of Portland, and we have, for those of you who don't, I'm not sure if you know, we don't actually own the P5 facilities. We only manage them. So we're the property manager. And that agreement was written in 1989, 88, something of that sort?
86.
Oh, okay. And so...
1920, actually.
1920. It was... Well, we have some buildings, right? But so it was a little unclear on what the... where the capital requirements came from. So that is the agreement we are still managing under. Of course, the buildings have gotten older. Capital needs are a little heavier. So we have to figure through some of those things. But yes, actually, the capital itself is part of our plan. We do insure all of these buildings, but
so I'm looking at the P5 slide. I just want to make sure I heard the right thing. So this growing red line represents both growing administrative and operational costs as well as growing capital costs for our share.
Yeah, this is just operations. Okay. This does not include capital, but what we've
done. Responsible for capital.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what we do with when we have a essentially net income or a positive, so like you'll look at 1920, we're looking at roughly $700,000 in additional cash from operations. That would fall to the bottom line, and we would typically use that for the deferred maintenance plan at the P5 facilities. So as that line squishes, as they come closer together, you don't have additional money going into the ending fund balance for P5. So the deferred maintenance, you have a lot difficult time because you spend out the ending fund.
Does the city of Portland also insure these buildings? Because, I mean, they're not ours. Why are we carrying the insurance?
I believe that's part of the agreement, but we do insure the buildings.
So this is a question to follow up on later. Okay. Is to follow up later, not today, but I'd like to know how we include that. It may not be our asset, but we are asset managing portions of an asset. And we know what the greater asset needs are, as well as what we're supposed to. I'd like to just have a conversation about how we're managing that and how that discussion then plays into any discussion we need to have with the city of Portland in the future.
Yeah, I think I'd be happy to brief you on sort of what is the capital management plan for P5, and actually it plays into the negotiations we were having over the VFIGA.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Councilor Craig. This might be along the same similar conversation, Martha, but today when we were meeting with Andrew Scott's team, we met with the capital planning person. So when it comes to newer renovations, like let's say ADA accessibility, and that would be a capital, is that the responsibility of the landlord or is that the responsibility of the owner? This might, again, be a part of the dialogue.
Yeah, why don't we talk to you about that as a larger briefing about P5 capital? Because as Tim says, the challenge is that the agreements we have with the city are not entirely clear about what kind of capital maintenance is Metro's responsibility and what is deferred for the city. And we're now with a couple of the buildings confronting the moment where I would say the moment of truth has arrived, at least on Keller. So.
Yes.
Hello.
Go ahead, Councillor.
Well, the question I was going to ask is what's going to be the help make the decision or help us take that step to really begin to work with the city of Portland and come to some kind of...
Well, we're already working with them, so let us get you a briefing, and you'll need to give us some policy guidance about the triggers that you want to include it in our negotiations with them. They've already done some facility condition assessment. I mean, we have a lot of information. It's just that we haven't had a policy-level conversation with you about where do you want to be. So that's what needs to happen.
Awesome. Thank you. Moving on.
All I want to say is
we're not moving on.
I'm more than ready to engage with any three other councillors who want to call the question about eliminating our exposure to risk for the city's properties. I've been there for 2 years. I welcome this interest in the topic, and I'd like to learn what discussions are underway, because I'm confident that nobody on the city council ever wants to talk about this.
But, I mean, they need to face the fact that they own these things they don't know they own.
But until we tell them that, they will not.
Well, I'm about to inform one of them via their staff, so welcome us to have a group conversation.
Sure.
So, Councilor Gonzalez?
I do have one more question. So, given the forecast for the blue line and I guess the red line, what factors do you take into account when forecasting our projected revenues? I mean, do you take into account, obviously, inflation, projected economic growth? How do you know we're not going to secure Hamilton every year?
It'd be awesome if we did. If you looked at the numbers last year, wow.
It's going to be the next Hamilton.
On the revenue side, on any budget, from a revenue perspective, we are typically very conservative, right? That is because you just can't count on the revenue. So you're conservative on the revenue side, and you're a little conservative that you're going to spend everything essentially on the expenditure side. So that is what we project. So again, we don't project that we're going to have 13 weeks of Broadway every year, because the year that you don't, right, you have this huge crash. So that's why we take a conservative approach to the revenue.
So can I say one more thing about this? Tim may or may not want me to say, which is every year we put our hands on the wheel of the budget of all of our enterprises, and we balance the budget. So even though he shows you in the out years a deficit, that's really more of a planning tool as opposed to, I always tell people, it's a planning tool, not a freak out moment. Mm-hmm. And we will balance the budget because the law requires us to balance the budget. So that's more of a early signal warning about what we can afford to add or what we need, what kinds of investments we need to make, as opposed to anything that, as I tell people, it's like we have concern but not alarm about that projection.
And we had a department briefing with Merck, and the executive director of the P5 spoke about some of the headwinds in the future. But I guess that could be a conversation for the future. Partnerships with the community organizations and the free spaces that we offer, and the revenues and the costs associated with that. So
I'm sure she spoke about the resident companies and the rent subsidies. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Now on to a former county facility that we own and manage.
So the next one is the Portland Expo Center. This one is not quite as rosy, even less rosy than, so it's kind of going like this. The one interesting thing you will notice on this graph is if you look at 2021, 22-23 and 25-26, you will see that the red and the blue line come really close together. Those are CERC years. Okay, so those are years in which CERC du Soleil comes and does roughly 6-8 weeks, right? So in a year in which CERC is here, we break even. In a year that we do not, if CERC is not here, we don't. Lose roughly $300,000-ish.
We finally built everything in South Waterfront that they were using in the past?
Yes. So, and they will be back, I believe, in actually the beginning of 21-22. Now, if you'll also see, there's a gold star in 24-25. That is actually the final year of the debt payment for Hall D.
Yeah.
And what that is right now the Expo Center pays $1 million a year in debt service. In that year, that $1 million expenditure falls off the books. So their $300,000 a year loss essentially is able to be covered right now by, one, $400,000 general fund transfer, and they're eating their fund balance that is non-capital related. So those two things right there should get us into 2024, but they're going to be close. So
in the meantime, please go to the drive-in movies every
go in,
summer.
Go to your antique shows, pay your $10 to park.
pay.
Just recommend I get in a car?
There's a max line that goes right there.
You can take max, but drop off 10 at the parking booth, please. That'd be great. Bring volunteers on the max and watch the movie outdoors.
So I've heard a future conversation around Columbia River Crossing and the type of infrastructure that we need would impact the facility and the real estate for Expo Center. I've also heard other people, both counselors and non-counselors, talk about future opportunities for that real estate in general. How does that kind of play into our forecast in the future that you do or that we're not doing?
So we'll have a separate conversation with you about Expo and perhaps even executive session conversation about the value of the property, but that won't impact what we do in the budget next year.
All of this is assuming that we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, right?
Correct. No major changes. So as we are set right now, nothing for CRC or any other changes at that time.
So as the Hyatt Hotel comes on and we begin to have more groups in Portland, hopefully, or it sounds like we're going to, that will be using the Oregon Convention Center, that will likely push out some of the current community events that are there, like the auto show, and or I assume that will be moving to the auto show. Will some of that be going to the Expo, is my question.
So right now, my understanding is, yes, the issue we run into at the Expo Center, if you're moving from OCC and want to go to the Expo Center, you typically don't want to go to halls A and B.
No, sorry.
And that is where we have the dates available. So it's going to be a real little put. Then they would have to decide, is this a more profitable event, or so there's a lot of things that need to happen. But the sales teams, my understanding is now that sales teams are actually talking, they're working together and looking at that. So
I would just say this whole thing is part of the conversation on the asset management, and we can put it in that policy discussion about the assets that we own in this realm and what we're doing.
Yeah, and this is also why you guys have kept the Expo Center business plan on your little number on the green sheet.
Yep.
And down below, and the sort of, you guys are at least putting a marker down, paying attention to it. You've left that item there to make sure that we don't lose track.
Okay. Ready? All right. The last slide I have, I'm going to talk about the zoo.
It's the best for last.
I'm going to talk about the zoo real quick, and then I'm going to talk about the solid waste rate very fastly. But so the zoo, if we look at 2017-2018 actuals, actually I'll take us 2 years back. When we moved the zoo from inside the general fund to its own enterprise fund, we sent it along with $1 million ending fund balance. Okay, the goal was to give it seed money to start. So in the first year that it was enterprise fund, it actually ate $200,000 into that. So it went from $1 million down to $800,000. Okay, then 17-18 happens. We have a great zoo lights. We actually increase the ending fund balance in 17-18. It goes up to $4 million. They now have a target of actual to try to hit $6.5 million. That is the reserve they are looking for to be able to function. Okay. You will see they, of course, are balanced in the 18-19 budget. 19-20 still looks positive. But again, we're very conservative in the revenue, and we look at the expenditures. I just met with Sarah Keene, who is the finance and admin program director up there today, and she believes that they're going to add another at least $400,000 to the ending fund in the current year. So we are making progress. I think we have to look at the team. They've done a lot of work, but this also tells us that it can be a little precipitous and something, you know, if we end up having to close for a week, for zoo lights, that will dramatically impact the overall revenue of the zoo. So the last 2 years we've had pretty good. I think this year we only closed one day. Year before, I think we only closed two. But like the year before, we closed a week and we ate into the ending fund. So those are things you have to watch for.
Do your revenues anticipate any cash infusion from the foundation side, or is that at zero?
Oh. No, we have regular, it's moved to where we have regular OZF contributions inside those now, correct? Yep.
Is there
They're built into the blue line.
Yeah. Yep.
So the thing about the zoo is it's just heavily weather dependent, right? Mm-hmm. Revenues are just like a golf course. They're heavily weather dependent, and it's both on the cold side and on the hot side. So we can have bad weather that's in August and July that will impact. So, so when he forecasts, he has to sort of average good and bad years.
So.
Did we see an uptick when Elephant Lands was open? And the reason I'm asking, I wonder if we'll see an uptick when Polar Passage opens in 20.
I think we did see an uptick. I actually think that the baby elephant was probably even bigger, though, than the
big baby elephant.
And I also know right after we opened Elephant Lands, it was when paid parking got implemented. So we saw an uptick from Elephant Lands, but a down push from paid parking. That's all leveled out now. So we might see a slight uptick. But, you know, really our experience tells us that you need the temperature to be between 50 and 85, and you need it to be sunny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, neither Tim nor I is unfortunately in control of that.
Why don't you just ask?
Policy statement, check.
So hopefully when the last of our projects is done and the zoo is, quote, done, unquote, so there's not major construction going on the campus. Hopefully that'll lead to uptick. And maybe, I mean, I know that one of our big challenges at the zoo is that from a standpoint of as a destination, it's kind of maxed out. We don't have room for more people to come to the zoo. There's nothing we can do to the zoo
in good days
to make people come to increase revenue, because we have many days where you really can't have any more people there. But I'm hoping that when it's complete, that'll mean there's more space and we actually can have more room for people, so we won't have that as much of a cap. I'll be interested to see what happens when all the it's completed.
We'll track it. I think that one of the benefits of the staff that's at the zoo now, Sarah Key in particular, has gotten very real with us about what the actual expectations we can have around maximum visitor attendance and how we could forecast that out. Like so many things, the zoo would benefit from us figuring out how to get people there during the so-called shoulder seasons when, you know, there's more people at zoo lights, more people in summer might not help us. More people in October, more people in February. That would help us.
Last year and the birth of Lily year, I think we're the mat there around 1.7. That's the max that we've got to. I don't know what can drive us really high, much higher than that. But right, right.
More elephant ears.
And shaved ice. High margins, please. Okay, then really quickly, lastly, is I'm sorry I don't have a chart here because we have we're still finalizing them, but we believe that the solid waste rate again in 1920 is going to be pretty much equivalent to what it has been roughly for the last 4 years, around the $94-$95-ish range. And the reason I bring that up is because as the council, begin to look at things, it would appear to me that there is some room in that rate because it has not grown for a while. So as you look at excise tax increases or long-term as we look at the INI program and actually adding that in as a regular program, probably needs to go into the regional system fee. And as we begin looking at expansions of South, Central, and potentially West, we're going to have both a cash and bond that will probably drive that rate up as we go. So just those things are on the horizon as we're thinking about doing these various changes, excise tax, regional system fee, etc.
Tip fee is not an excise tax, it's a charge for services.
So the tonnage charge, So the tip fee is the total of the three. Tip fee is the total of the three.
I used the wrong.
Tonnage, excise tax, and regional system fee. Tonnage is the actual garbage. So that varies to a certain degree. But actually, we see bigger swings inside the regional system fee and the excise tax because of the sheer number of tons we have. So, and that's what I have.
I was going to ask, the INI fund, is that the innovation?
I'm sorry, innovation, yes. Ideas and innovation.
Investment.
Innovation group, yes.
distributing to, for creativity.
Correct. In the current year, it's $3 million. We're looking at expanding that up to $6 million. If that now becomes a permit, which we're basically using fund balance to fund those, as this that becomes part of the actual program, you're looking at saying, yes, we want to do this every year, then that probably actually should be added to the regional system fee, which at 1.5 million tons is roughly $4 a ton. So,
I think this is really helpful to get a background. Much appreciated.
Absolutely.
And is there any last comments that you want in preparation for other budget discussions based on this?
No, I think what you need to know about what we're doing in terms of preparing a proposed budget is, first of all, we are pretty cautious about adding new program to the general fund that's not very directly linked to a council initiative. So that work that you did on Tuesday morning is really important because, frankly, if it's not on that list, it's probably not going to get added, even though a department has requested it. Second thing is, I think you know, some of you know, that my philosophy is that government needs to be reliable, right? So that I will be looking at strategies today to make sure that we don't have to do significant changes or reductions in year three, year four, or year five. Third, we'll be prioritizing any investment that we can think of that actually lowers our operating costs. So things that might make us more energy efficient, that might make better use of technology, that might help us make more efficient use of existing buildings. Those will be highest priority for the sort of discretionary stuff. And then last but not least, we'll be looking at creative financing strategies to try to maybe shift some costs out of the general fund, which is the most pressured, so that we have don't have to think about reductions in year three. So when you see the proposed budget, that'll be kind of what's behind it, if that made sense.
Much appreciated, yep. Both of you. Thank you. And everybody behind the scenes who put a lot of information into a very simple graph.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. With that, any further communications for the day? Martha, council, any further questions? What's coming up next on the budget?
So Tim and I will finalize the proposed budget. So we have to actually finalize the numbers 1st of March, and then it goes into Lisa's black box. I'm kidding, if not. It has to balance, right? So any decisions I make then have to be worked through the entire budget to make sure it balances. You'll get a proposed budget right around spring break. Just as a reminder for new counselors, Oregon budget law says we send it out to you, and until I actually verbally present the budget message to you on April 11th, you can't talk to each other about it. You can talk to Tim, you can talk to me, you can talk to Andrew, you can talk to any staff person, but you're not allowed to deliberate in any way. So when you get it, make sure that you write your questions and get ready. Then you'll have some time to deliberate before you have to take your first action. I think the first week of May, is that correct, or the last week of April? The first week of May. So you'll get time to deliberate. I just want you to know when you first get the draft document, before you get the verbal presentation on camera, you can't actually talk to each other under Oregon budget law. So I know it's weird, isn't it? Oregon has really unusual budget law.
I've never heard that.
Yes, it's true, though.
I believe you.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering why I've never heard it before. All right. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very nice.
I don't know why you've never heard it before. You have good staff who did budget work.